The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
Hello and welcome to the CFB Podcast, a long ago familiar voice to you. Ivan Maisel here. I'm with my friend and colleague, Ryan McGee. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, and happy holidays. And we'll see if everyone remembers how we used to do this podcast.
That's right. There will be no Kevin Nagandi, no Herbie, no Pollock today. They gave it to us to do what is one of the favorite tasks that Ryan and I have undertaken, and certainly our favorite together for a number of years, and that is a memoriam show to remember the people who make college football into what we love so, the people who died in 2020. We were going to try to remember some of the prominent and less prominent names from the sport. And Ryan, it's funny. I think with college football, because of the emotional tie that we have to our teams and the passion that the sport engenders, that to me is unlike any other, certainly American sport, that is what makes this show imperative to do. And I think why we like to do it so much.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there's no sport that's more nostalgic than college football. You know, when you walk into any college football stadium, whether it's a Division II school somewhere that you never heard of, or whether it's Notre Dame, you literally walk in past the plaques and the statues and, you know, this building's named for this guy who was the star of the conference championship team from 19, whatever. And so I think that, you know, you root for the laundry. And the legends of the laundry, you know, are why we love the sport so much.
That's exactly it. And there are some, as I said, some names that everybody will recognize. And there are a few names here that only the fans of that team or the teams they were associated with may recognize. But here we go. And I'm going to start off with a name probably better known for his pro football career than his college career, Chris Dolman, who is a Pro Football Hall of Famer, and had a terrific NFL career, but was a star on some good and not very good teams at Pittsburgh in the early 80s. He played from 1981 to 1984, 25 sacks in his collegiate career. And what struck me about him, Ryan, is that as a freshman, he played on a team that was 11-1. But at the end of that season, Jackie Sherrill, the coach, got mad at the AD and the administration at Pitt, and A&M wooed him with the spectacular amount of not quite $300,000 a year to come to Texas A&M. And he left. Foge Fazio took over at Pitt, and the program slowly lost air over Dolman's last 3 years. But he was just such an incredible player. John Congemi, the quarterback on those teams, said that Dolman ran like a wide receiver, and yet he played on the defensive front. Just a terrific player, and died young, terribly young, at the age of 58 last January.
Yeah, I'm the perfect example of what you're talking about, which is I was so aware of his incredible pro career. I mean, 8 Pro Bowls and Defensive Player of the Year, and I want to say made the All-Decade Team in the 90s.
And yeah, I think he did.
Yeah, but I think you had to kind of look up to remember. I remember when I covered a game at Pittsburgh, and you get there, and obviously, you know, it's all these legends that you know went to school there, and then you see you saw Chris Dolman's name, and I honestly, and I think it's because of what you talked about. Unfortunately, he was there for kind of the erosion.
Well, in 1984, his senior season, they started out as number 3, and they made a national champion that year. BYU beat him early in the season.
Right.
And nobody, people had understood that Pitt wasn't very good, BYU wouldn't have gotten up and out in front of people the way that they did. But by the end of the season, when BYU was the only undefeated, people didn't really care that, you know, their biggest win was over a 3-win Pitt team. So he had a small hand in the national championship, I guess you would say.
So are you saying that even prior to the college football playoff, brand names mattered when it came to who received attention?
Well, maybe in 1984, certainly not today, Ryan McGee. I think we all understand that.
Yeah. Oh, well, speaking of brand names, we lost Paul Hornung this year. And the Golden Boy, you know, it's funny. We talk all the time about brand names and erosion of status or whatever, but Notre Dame obviously is still Notre Dame. And I would argue that players of today or you know, young people of today don't know certain names, but they probably knew who Paul Hornung was because he never really went away. No. You know, for me, by the time I came along and I was in college, certainly, he hadn't played any sort of football in a couple of decades. And I knew who the Golden Boy was because he was on television all the time. And I remember there was a syndicated show. He used to do a Paul Hornung preseason college football show where he just traveled around. It basically, I think it was an excuse for him to travel around and drink with his old buddies. And then, you know, say, oh, and by the way, they're my preseason number 8 pick. And I say all that to tell this story that you've heard before, but I'm going to tell it anyway. And it's tied to another name on our list, which is Johnny Majors. And when I was a student at the University of Tennessee, Johnny Majors was the head football coach. And Paul Hornung's preseason college football special, he had chosen Tennessee as his preseason number 1 team. This would have been like probably 1990, 91. And I was on the video crew at Tennessee, the student video team, and we were helping Paul Hornung's crew shoot his show. And he came in August, and we set him up in Coach Majors' office. And they're old friends. And in 1956, when Paul Hornung won the Heisman Trophy, that Notre Dame team had won 2 games.
Yes.
And he won the Heisman Trophy over Johnny Majors, one of Tennessee's long list of distinguished Heisman runner-ups. And Coach Majors, who was a dear friend of me and a mentor, it had a huge impact on my life, but Coach Majors would get a little chippy if you brought up that 1956 Heisman Trophy vote. And so Paul Hornung comes in and we set him up, and Coach Majors at his desk and Paul Hornung sitting in the chair, and we all know where this is going. And as soon as the cameras start rolling, Hornung says, all right, Coach Majors, head coach of Tennessee Volunteers, but listen, before we get to anything else, let's get the elephant, you know, take care of the elephant in the room. Who really should have won the Heisman Trophy in 1956? And without even pausing, Johnny Majors goes, Jimmy Brown. Next question. And Paul Hornung could not stop laughing. And so then they do the interview. And then as we're tearing down the equipment, the two of them went to the bar. And so that's my Paul Hornung and Johnny Majors story. And it's still a very sensitive topic around Knoxville about that 1956 Heisman. But Paul
Hornung, Majors was in the lead. Well, he was, I don't know if there was such a thing as a favorite then, but he suffered a terrible sprained ankle in what was like the next to last game of the season or the third to last, and you know, just disappeared from the radar.
Yeah. And Coach Majors, what he led, and this was one of the very first post Robert Nealon teams, but this was the team that was contending for national championship, and he led the team and I believe the conference in passing, rushing, and also return yards. So he was a Christian McCaffrey kind of guy in 1956. Ooh. On a team that won a lot of games. And Paul Hornung was a Christian McCaffrey kind of guy who was on a team that won 2 games. So I'm not bitter at all, but I'm just saying, as a Tennessee alum, that's still, I mean, we can have an entire podcast about all of Tennessee's runner-up Heisman Trophy guys, but that was the 1956 story is still my favorite one. I love the fact that those two guys owned it and had such a good time with it.
Well, Majors, Hornung was 84, died last month. Majors was 85, died in June. And, of course, our generation remembers Majors as the guy who won a national championship at Pittsburgh before Jackie Sherrill and was the predecessor of Jackie Sherrill. And then, you know, didn't he write a book, You Can Go Home Again? He went home. Johnny Majors went to Tennessee, and he was successful. He wasn't. He didn't achieve that level of success that, you know, every SEC fan base demands, but he was successful.
Yeah. And I think about I mean, the 4 years that I was in school, which were the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and it was those teams were the worst of those teams was probably the most talented of those teams with Carl Pickens and Alvin Harper and Charlie Garner, and they went 9-2-2. And to me, that year kind of sums up the Johnny Majors era at Tennessee, which is that team won the conference and won the Sugar Bowl, but it's still everyone was still a little unsatisfied. And Coach Majors, of course, had a falling out with the university. There was the book I'll write one day is about the coup d'etat that happened there with his successor, Philip Fulmer, who's currently the athletic director. But the good news is that in his last years, Coach Majors buried the hatchet with his alma mater. And that made a lot of us very happy because it was a source of tension that was just too much. And Johnny Majors literally died sitting on the back porch of his house with a drink in his hand, looking over the Tennessee River. And that makes me very happy because if he could have chosen a way to go, that's how he would have chosen it.
That's terrific. Johnny Majors died on June 3rd. And the only reason I bring that up is that 2 days earlier, the sport lost two people. One of whom was Lee Grosskopf, who was a longtime fixture on ABC's coverage of college football, and long before that, a quarterback at Utah, and a highly successful one. And, of course, the other one was one of Johnny Major's oldest friends and rivals, Pat Dye, the longtime Auburn coach and athletic director. Let's talk about Lee Grosskopf, because I don't want to just get to him at the end, because I want to spend more time on Pat Dye, especially because of his relationship with Majors. But Lee Grosskopf is what I remember about him. Well, I didn't remember him, but it just struck a chord when I did some research on him. You know, the little shovel pass that's called the Utah pass?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was Lee Grosskopf.
Wow.
At Utah. The coach was a guy with the wonderful name of Cactus Jack Curtis.
That's awesome.
Who left Utah and went to Stanford, where he was pretty mediocre. But nonetheless, Lee Grosskopf in, 1957, the year after Majors almost won the Heisman, completed 69% of his passes. And this was in an era when nobody else got – if you got anywhere near 60%, you were considered, you know, NFL material. And Lee Grosskopf, because of the shovel pass, the whoopee pass or Utah pass that they called it, completed 68.6% of his passes, finished 10th in the Heisman in 1957, then got hurt, didn't play much in 1958. And he had a pretty average career in both the NFL and AFL before, of course, the leagues merged. But he found his niche, as far as college football is concerned, but as a longtime analyst and studio analyst at ABC Sports. Then he, for many years, was on the University of California radio team. He died at the age of 83. Was a nice man by all accounts. But... of course, on that day, his obituary in college football was overshadowed by Pat Dye. And Pat Dye won 153 games in his college coaching career at East Carolina, at Wyoming, and at Auburn. And wanted the Auburn job so much that he resigned from the job at Wyoming before he got the job offer from Auburn.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, pretty remarkable. But Wyoming had – there was some sort of contract snafu where he had never signed the deal. And he coached the year, and then finally, you know, Auburn came sniffing around, and somebody realized he hadn't signed his deal. And they said to him, you know, either sign it or you're done. And he said, okay, then I'm done. And a few days later, Auburn hired him. And of course, he famously not only – was a protege of Bear Bryant, had been an All-American lineman at Georgia for Wally Butts, and it was on the offensive line that protected Fran Tarkington at Georgia. And then became a very young assistant coach for Bear Bryant when he got, after Dye got out of the service in the mid 60s. And Bryant loved Pat Dye. And he got him started in his coaching career, and Dye famously came back. And when he got the job offer at Auburn, he called Bryant and said, "I'm going to take the job." And Bryant said, "The hell you are. I want you to," he said, "I want you to replace me. And, you know, I'm going to quit pretty soon." And, you know, and I said something, in fact, "The coach, you've been saying that for years." And, you know, little did they know, you know, that this was, Dye only coached 2 years against Bryant, and of course beat him in Bryant's last Iron Bowl, which was the game that sort of announced, okay, Pat Dye has got Auburn on the right track. They won four SEC titles there, three in a row from 87 to 89. And anybody within that knows anything about the history of the SEC understands that Dye's biggest contribution to Auburn was getting the Iron Bowl into Jordan-Hare Stadium. And if, you know, the best way to tell that story is for me to tell you to go watch Saturdays in the South, which is Fritz Mitchell's wonderful documentary about the history of the SEC. The episode about the 80s just tells a wonderful story about Dye, how he engineered it, and then that day itself, which was as frenzied and emotional day as I've ever witnessed and covered in my career. You know, Pat Dye left Auburn under a cloud after the 1992 season. And as good a coach as he was, Ryan, his Iron Bowls, he was 6-6.
Yeah.
Yeah. He split with Bryant. He did beat Bill Curry 3 years in a row, but then he turned around and lost to Gene Stallings 3 years in a row. So, but he was an adopted Auburn man, but became as big an Auburn man as there has been, certainly in our lifetime.
Well, now imagine the shock that I experienced as a teenager when I was watching Auburn and Georgia, and I suddenly realized that Vince Dooley went to Auburn and Pat Dye went to Georgia. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. And I joke about Pat Dye, but I loved what Gus Malzahn did this year in the first Auburn game after Pat Dye's death, where he wore, to me, it's the symbol of Pat Dye, which was that distinctive sideline uniform of a short sleeve Oxford shirt with a necktie and a baseball cap.
Yep.
And I actually, when I was in college, Tennessee played Auburn when I was a student at Tennessee right around Halloween. And a group of us went to a Halloween party in college, all dressed as Pat Dye. I got to tell him that story several years ago. And his response was, he goes, "Well, I assume all of you left with the best looking girls that were at the party, if you were dressed very like nice. Me." I said, "Yeah, coach." But it was for me, that era of coaches, and we talk about Johnny Majors and Pat Dye and Gene Stallings and Vince Dooley, and they were all coached in that same era, and they all kind of disappeared at the same time, you know, yeah, as from the sideline. And so that was kind of, to me, the last generation of the larger than life, you know.
And took their brand of football with them. I mean, because right, as they disappeared, Steve Spurrier showed up.
Yeah.
Well, the best Pat Dye quote was in the coaching interview at Auburn when they asked him how long would it take to beat Alabama. And he just stared at him and said, 60 minutes. And they fell in love with him right there. Because Bear Bryant was larger than life in that state, and he had been beating Auburn for years and years. That was a big loss for Auburn and for storytelling in the SEC when we lost Pat Dye.
Well, and when I think about larger than life coaches, it doesn't get any bigger than Don Shula, who we also lost this year. And also, you know, we all know about the Dolphins. We all know about his Pro Football Hall of Fame career, obviously, as a coach, you know, the Colts and everyone else. But I don't know a whole lot about the history of John Carroll University football, but I'm assuming that Don Shula is the biggest star they ever had. It's but Coach Shula, my interactions with him were later in his life when I would run into him at events, at the Orange Bowl, at Shula Steakhouse, you know, wherever. And I, that aura that you talk about of a head football coach, when he walked in the room, he had that aura, yes. But then also was immediately disarming. And when he realized who he was, which is happening in every room he ever walked into, I don't know what your interactions were like with Coach Shula, but that's what every interaction I have with him, whether it was an official interview or it was just running into him in a press box somewhere, I was so awestruck. And then after 5 minutes, felt like I was just talking to, you know, your uncle telling football stories.
Yeah. I didn't know him well. I think I only met him once now that I think about it. But what always struck me was how normal and unaffected by celebrity status his sons Dave and Mike were, you know, both of whom went into coaching and both of whom I covered at various times. And they were not impressed with themselves and didn't expect you to be impressed with them just because their name was Shula. And that's a credit to the parents, you know, so that's, to me, that was always a big feather in Don Shula's cap.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And we lost, of course he had the great Miami Dolphins team that loved to remind us that they didn't lose a game. And one of the anchors of those teams in the 70s was Jake Scott.
Oh yeah.
And one of my favorite stories written in the last 20 years that I can remember was Dave Hyde with the South Florida Sun Sentinel back in the day tracked down Jake Scott. And for folks that don't know, Jake Scott was, well, first of all, he was born in Greenwood, South Carolina, just down the road from where I graduated high school. And see, I would hear about him, but he actually graduated high school in Virginia, really grew up in Georgia, was an All-American at the University of Georgia as a defensive back, and then went to Miami, and he was an anchor on these football teams and went to a ton of Pro Bowls. And then he just kind of vanished.
Yes.
And, you know, he took his winnings from the Super Bowl and bought a ranch, I want to say in Colorado, and then eventually ended up in Hawaii. And I encourage anyone to look up this story that was written, again, by David Hyde, I want to say 2005 or 2006, and found Jake Scott living in Hawaii and asked the question, you know, so what do you do every day? And he said, and I get up and I try to decide, am I going to take a nap or am I going to go fishing or am I going to have a drink? And most days I'm doing all three. And God bless him, but was a recluse. I mean, to the point that even when his name started coming up for Hall of Fames, you know, Vince Dooley had to call and basically beg him to participate in these events. And at one point, I think he had a falling out with Dooley, but Coach Dooley's always said that was a little overblown story-wise, but a fascinating, fascinating character, and passed away in his beloved Hawaii, earlier this year.
Yeah, last month he was 75 years old, and one of the reasons it took so long for him to get into the Hall of Fame is that they wanted him to come to New York, and he just wasn't all that interested. And if you're a movie buff, the movie The Descendants, starring George Clooney, about the guy about a widowed father in Hawaii. There is a scene in Jake Scott's bar, and Jake is in the scene. He's one of the characters in the scene. So that gives you a window into why it was so hard to get him off that island, because it looked pretty chill.
Yeah, it looked pretty good.
Yeah. as long as we're in the SEC and a lot of big names in the SEC, we lost this year, and this one most recently, Ray Perkins. Who died 3 weeks ago. He was 79 years old. We talked about Pat Dye. Ray Perkins and Pat Dye met in four Iron Bowls in the mid-80s, but in which they split. And Ray Perkins was the a tough man. From the time he was that toughness showed up when he was a high schooler. It showed up throughout his career. He took on replacing Bear Bryant at Alabama. That's how tough, that's how mentally tough he was. He went 32-15 with one tie in four seasons at Alabama. And of course, that was not good enough for the Alabama fans in the wake of Bryant's death. But there was so much he did at Alabama that to try to get to bring it into the modern day. And he did it without trying to sell it. He did it, just came in and ripped off the scab and of after Bryant died, and it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. You know, he immediately took down Bear Bryant's coaching tower. He immediately for better financial deals threw Coke and Golden Flake off as sponsors of Alabama football in favor of Pepsi and Frito-Lay, which was heretical among Alabama fans. You know, and then never won the SEC. Had a losing season his second year. Had good teams, not great ones. And then after four seasons, went back to the NFL from whence he came. He was also an All-American wide receiver at Alabama on that 1966 team that, 64, 65, 66. They went 32-1, 30 wins, two losses, and a tie in his three seasons, two national championships. And in 1966, of course, the only unbeaten, untied team, and finished third behind Notre Dame and Michigan State. He was just a as you said with Majors, in his later years, Ken was beloved at Alabama, and it was a real sense of loss in that community when he died. He had, was just a fixture for so long with the university, and Ray Perkins died at age 79.
You mentioned that mid-1960s stretch, and I just – that was before my time, and I'm sad that it is, because I just sit there and just stare at film of it and of that era and the brand of football that they played. And the person that I'm most drawn to in that era was a two-time All-American in 63 and 64, and that's Gale Sayers. And we lost Gale Sayers September 23rd. He was 77 years old. And, you know, if you're my age, then you grew up in the era where you subscribed to Sports Illustrated and they would send you the NFL Films VHS videotape. And I remember there was a VHS called Crunch Course. And it was just all about the hardest hits and all these guys. And they showed you like Earl Campbell and all these guys running the ball. And then they showed you Gale Sayers. And, you know, we all knew about Walter Payton, and we all knew about O.J. Simpson, and we all knew about these incredible NFL runners. And we're all like, who is this guy? And we just didn't know, because he was kind of ahead of my era. And it was Gale Sayers. And so as a result, I found myself reading his book, and I found myself tracking down film anywhere I could find it. And then, because I go to Omaha every June for the College World Series and wrote a worst-selling book about the College World Series, and one of the things that one of the chapters is about the incredible history of North Omaha athletes. And from the exact same neighborhood, Bob Boozer, Bob Gibson, Marlon Briscoe, the first black quarterback to start in the National Football League, they all came from a Bud Crawford boxer. They all came from the exact same neighborhood in North Omaha. And Gale Sayers was kind of the anchor of that group. And I was in the most outspoken of that group. That was kind of a reclusive group. And I had the chance to speak with him several times. But, I mean, the life that he led, I mean, Brian's Song, for heaven's sakes. It's just an incredible career. And the numbers that he posted at the University of Kansas, still hold up to this day, you know, even in the offensive explosion era. And I think about a game I tracked down and watched film of was, it was his senior year of 64, and Kansas is playing Oklahoma. And I want to say Oklahoma was number one at that point. And he started the game with a 90-plus yard kickoff return for a touchdown. And that set the tone for an upset win in that game. And so Gale Sayers, to me, is an athlete that, unfortunately, I don't think receives the credit because his name wasn't as big. And his pro career was cut short because of injury.
Sure.
But a human highlight film. And, yes. And it's just still amazing to watch what he did.
I think he was the first African-American athletic director in Division I at Southern Illinois. I could be wrong. I mean, I know he was the athletic director at Southern Illinois. I think that's true. He went on a varied career as a businessman. And certainly he's a – I don't know if he's the greatest player ever at Kansas, but he's on the short list, no question. And was Johnny Rogers from that neighborhood in Omaha?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Good.
North Omaha. I mean, it's just this, the list is crazy. And I've always wanted to write a book about that, and I got beat to it. So there's a couple
of really
good books out there about that neighborhood. But it's what an amazing, amazing athlete.
Well, you brought up, it made me think of another guy we lost, a sort of slight, really quick, fast guy, Ricky Dixon. A star defensive back at Oklahoma in the mid-80s. Ricky died on August 1st. He was only 53 years old. He had struggled with ALS for 7 years. And it was just one of those classic recruiting stories. You know, Barry Switzer found him in Dallas, and the only other offer he had was from Houston. And Barry took a chance on him, even though he wasn't that big, but it turned out he was not only fast, but he loved to hit. He finished his career at Oklahoma. He played on a national championship team as a freshman, redshirt freshman in 1985. And he finished his career with 17 interceptions, which was second at that time in school history, only to Darryl Royal. So just an incredible player. Shared the Jim Thorpe Award in 1987 with Benny Blades of Miami. You know, that's a pretty good start on a secondary there. And just an unassuming guy. Went on, he had a good career in the NFL, moved back to his neighborhood in Dallas. He grew up a few miles south of the Cotton Bowl. And I met him at the Cotton Bowl one day to talk about the neighborhood and having the Texas OU game come to his neighborhood every year, and then playing in it. And he was just really excited to talk about it. It meant so much to him. What a shame. He died only at the age of 53.
Well, and talking about losing people way too early, Tavares Jackson, when he died in a car crash on April 12th, was just 9 days shy of his 37th birthday. Mm-hmm. And was playing in the NFL as late as 2015. For folks that don't remember him as a college player, started at Arkansas, went to Arkansas as a quarterback, suffered an injury, and then transferred closer to home. He's from Montgomery, Alabama, and he transferred to Alabama State and was an all-conference in the SWAC quarterback, and then played in the National Football League. I honestly didn't realize this. He played in the league almost a decade and was Russell Wilson's backup in the 2014 Super Bowl. And I had the chance to chat with him. He went back to Alabama State as a quarterbacks coach and then was at Tennessee State, unfortunately, when he passed away. But he was what I loved talking to him about was how much – HBCU football meant to him and how it gave him a second chance because he's going to Arkansas and he's going to play in the SEC. And then he ended up going back home. And in his mind a little bit, he talked about, maybe I'm kind of settling, you know, and then he realized this was the place for him. And he took a lot of pride in the history of HBCU football and the fact that that's what propelled him to the National Football League, and he backed up Matt Jones at Alabama State. And so he's I really enjoyed my chats with him, and unfortunately died in a car accident entirely too young. But Tavarius Jackson, a Super Bowl champion and a champion of HBCU football.
Another guy we lost very early and recently, just last month, Marcus Paul, who was 54 years old, the assistant strength coach at the Cowboys. I remembered Marcus when my first season covering the sport nationally was 1987. And Marcus was a standout defensive back on the Syracuse team that went 11-0 in the regular season that year, tied Auburn in the Sugar Bowl. He was an anchor in that defensive team. What struck me, that's what I remembered about him, Ryan. It's just that he was a good player on a really good team. But to read what people said about him after he died, the Cowboy team was devastated, and almost to a man, everybody interviewed who either played with him or coached with him or coached him all said the same things about what a great guy he was, how he was sort of the glue of the team. He worked hard. He didn't get mad. I reached out to Don McPherson, who was the quarterback on that Syracuse team, and I just wanted to read you how he responded about Marcus. He said, Marcus came to Syracuse as a quarterback, defensive back recruit, and we roomed in training camp his freshman year before he moved to defensive back. He was one of the nicest, most caring human beings I've ever known, and by far one of the best I ever played with. He said, that's part of what made him so special. As a player, he had two speeds, full and collision. He said, one spring we implanted some offensive and defensive wrinkles that led to Marcus and I colliding a few times a day. They were the type of collisions that in today's game would lead to an ejection and suspension. And we did that a few times a day, every day. He said, he was the best teammate you could ever have, because he made you better by bringing the best of himself, which he did with a smile and a laugh, because he was truly having fun and enjoyed competing at the highest level, and it made us all better. I don't know what else you could say about a guy as a teammate that would be any better than that.
In the two speeds quote, that's one of the best quotes. Yeah, that's those teams were so good and so much fun. We have a tendency, especially now, to just forget about the anchors on those teams. I'm so glad you reached out to McPherson about that.
Yeah, he was really torn up about it. And everybody, Darryl Johnston, another guy on those teams, you know, he said, why can't I? He used to ask himself, why can't I live more like Marcus? Which is an astounding thing to say, you know, but. It was a guy that, you know, when you read about him, you wish you had known him better. So we lost Marcus Paul.
I mentioned the HBCUs and another champion of what those programs have meant to so many young men and so many college football fans over the years is Willie Davis. And we lost Willie Davis earlier this year at the age 85. But what a life. And if I'm being 100% honest with you, as a young aspiring broadcaster, I knew Willie Davis's name because he owned a bunch of radio stations. And I was like, you know, his name kept popping up on job applications. And I had seen Willie Davis interviewed again, watching these NFL films, you know, eight VHS tapes. I would see Willie Davis interviewed. It was a phenomenal interview. And I got to meet him one time and I told him that, and he started laughing and he said, yeah, he goes, I was pretty good playing football. I'm like, yeah, but he was also a great executive. I mean, he worked at, I know he was on the board of the NAB, which is the National Association of Broadcasters. And he was on I looked it up earlier today. He's on like 20 corporate boards. I mean, like Sara Lee and MGM, and he was on the 84 Olympic, planning committee.
And wasn't he in the beer business also?
Yeah. And it was, I mean, to call him an entrepreneur is an insult, you know, to the word entrepreneur, but also just a phenomenal interview. And one of his favorite topics was, and for folks that don't know, I mean, he was on, he played for the Browns. He played for the Packers. You know, he played on the legendary Packers team that won the first two Super Bowls with Paul Hornung, who we mentioned earlier.
Yep.
But Willie Davis loved to talk about playing at Grambling State, and he loved to talk about Eddie Robinson. And again, a champion whenever he had the chance to talk about, you know, his time at Grambling, and, you know, wasn't picked until the 15th or 16th round of the NFL draft. And because of where he had played college football.
Sure.
And ended up making the all decade team of the NFL in the 60s. And he's in every Hall of Fame that there is. And, but just a gregarious is the word I keep thinking of, because it's just funny. And the stories, you talk about a man that can tell stories about Eddie Robinson and also tell stories about Vince Lombardi. That's a pretty good life.
That's a pretty good life to have played for those two guys. You know, and we've brought up a lot of big names. This was a guy I want to describe next that was – he was a college football lifer, died young, too soon, after a 31-year career as an assistant coach, Osha Lewis, been most recently at Vanderbilt. He died in the spring. He was only 57 years old, had cancer, spent his last years with Derek Mason, first on the field and then in the office because of his health. What struck me about Osha Lewis when I read about him, Ryan, was his he was the quintessential guy who didn't he didn't meet the measurables. He was a 6 foot, 225 pound linebacker in the 80s, which is, you know, that's a guy that ended up signing at Oregon State because he was only 6 feet, 225 pounds. And those Beaver teams in the 80s were not very good.
Oh.
But he had a day. He had one day. They went in 1985, his senior year, they went to play Washington. And Washington was one of the best teams in the country. And Oregon State was one of the worst. And the night before the game, one of the local sportscasters started making jokes about Oregon State, and the team is watching the sportscast, you know, and it's in the hotel. And he said that, you know, it was kind of, he equated playing Oregon State to a bye week. And there was a Seattle columnist who called Oregon State the Barney Fife of college football. Well, Oregon State came out that day and beat Washington 21-20, and Osha Lewis made 21 tackles. 21 tackles, and on the decisive – Dan Raley, a longtime sports writer in Seattle, wrote a terrific obit about Osha Lewis, and he's the one who I'm stealing these anecdotes from. And you know, there was one goal line stand. They start out – Washington start out first and goal at the one. And Osha Lewis made the tackle on first down to knock him back. And on third down, he not only knocked the running back backward, he knocked him out of the game, Vince Weatherby, who was a good running back. And Oregon State won that day. And after that game, they sent the sportscaster – no, they sent the columnist in Seattle who had written the column, calling him Barney Fife, they sent him the game ball, which is just – that's a great – college football upset story.
That's fantastic. No, that's so all you young local sportscasters out there listening, be careful. You might win a game ball for all the wrong reasons. That's what a great story.
Yeah.
Merritt Norell, most people these days know him as Jay's dad. Jay, of course, the head football coach at the University of Nevada, but he was a groundbreaking athletic administrator, also a pretty good football player. He was a halfback for Wisconsin when they won the Big Ten, played in the Rose Bowl in the early 60s, and went on to become the athletic director at Michigan State. And he was one of the first black athletic directors, and certainly one of the first at what we call now the Power Five level.
Yep.
And also had a pretty good eye for talent. He was athletic director at Michigan State in the second half of the 1990s. And his football coach was Nick Saban. Ron Mason was his hockey coach, and Tom Izzo was his basketball coach. So, yeah, he knows coaches. And oh, by the way, also what a bloodline. I mean, he's obviously, we know about his son being head coach in Nevada, and his other son's an actor. If you've seen the movie Necessary Roughness, which is, of course, a college football classic, his son is Featherstone, the wide receiver. And so, what a career, and also a businessman who stayed there in Madison most of his life, except for his time in East Lansing. But, 79 years old, Merritt Norvell, groundbreaking football player and also athletic director.
The University of Washington lost somebody really dear to them, Jim Lambright, who died last spring, 77 years old, and he was the guy that replaced Don James when Don James suddenly retired in the early 90s. And Lambo he spent his entire adult life pretty much at the University of Washington. He played there. He became a coach there at a very young age, still in his, I think he was still in his 20s. He was 26 years old when he was hired as an assistant coach at UW in 1969, and never worked at another school again. Just a guy known for his passion. His teammates at UW voted him the most inspirational. Just a one of those guys that just brought so much energy into a room. And you've seen a lot of assistant coaches like that, and a few head coaches. And he had a good career. He was 44-25-1 at UW. But, you know, they were coming off a national championship-type program with Don James, and he didn't match that. And after six seasons, he was let go by an athletic director named Barbara Hedges, who left Washington not long after that, and Lambo really never left. And his son played there. His daughter played in the band at UW, and he was just a fixture and one of those guys. It's hard to imagine Washington football continuing without him.
I want to say this too. This is not a complete list, but these are some of the names that you and I have picked.
Yes,
from a long list that we've lost, and the last one on my list, of course, is a football official. I saved this one just for you, Paul Schmidt. And Paul Schmidt passed away during the summer, back in June, at the age of 82. And he was a longtime white hat, a longtime college football referee. And he also was a college football officiating administrator, a coordinator. And, you know, so back in the day, kids, before everyone joined the conference, the list of independent schools wasn't just, you know, Army, Notre Dame, Liberty, you know, that the very short list. It was a long list of really great football programs, and they needed officials. And so Paul Schmidt and his father, who was also a longtime sports official, they formed a group that were known as the Southern Independents, is what they were known in the college football officiating community. And so, you know, this was South Carolina and Louisville and Florida State and Miami, and there was also an Eastern group that was, you know, it was Pitt and it was Penn State. I mean, it was an insanely talented bunch of football programs, and he oversaw the officials that worked those games. And the most famous game that he was involved in was, he was the white hat who was in the Flutie game. And yes, ultimately, he's the one that had to, sign off on the touchdown. He also is the official who had to inform Brian Bosworth that he was no longer eligible to play in the bowl game last year. That's part of the job.
But the Orange Bowl, yeah.
Exactly. But if you know about college football officiating, and I do, I mean, the people that worked under him and learned the game from him were Al Riveron, who's ever seen officiating in the NFL for a year, Jerry Austin, who was a white hat in the NFL forever and is now the Conference USA officiating supervisor. And he also was very instrumental in, it wasn't only until the last several years that we've seen a lot of black officials on the field, referees, and we've seen female officials start to break into the collegiate ranks. And Paul Schmidt was super, super instrumental in that. And it went back to his time as a high school referee in Kentucky. And there were a lot of games that he saw that he felt like were going the wrong way, officiated the wrong way, simply because of the color of the skin of the athletes in the games. And and all the officials around him looked just like him. And so he worked hard to make sure that that was fixed. And the last time I saw Mr. Schmidt was, he was still an evaluator all the way into his 70s, sitting in the press box. And my officiating nerd radar would always go off and I would go talk to him. And the stories were off the chart. But you shake the hand of the man who signaled that Tug Flutie just threw a touchdown pass against Miami. That's a good hand to shake.
Very cool. Yeah, he was a legend among officials, and really sorry to see him go. I have two names, both died at the age of 92, that I wanted to finish up with, and one was of course Bill Yeoman, the longtime legendary coach at the Houston Cougars, 25 seasons, the one who shepherded Houston into the Southwest Conference because they were so good. He had made them so good. And you know, as soon as they got in there, they won the Southwest Conference in their first season in 1976. He won it three more times. He won 160 games in his 25 seasons. And before that, of course, he had played at Army on those great post-war teams of Red Blakes. Was on the line that blocked for Glenn Davis and Doc Blanchard, Mr. Inside and Mr. Outside. Their senior season was his sophomore season. So I wanted to be sure we recognized Bill Yeoman and a man that I was struck just by his story, Dr. John Najarian, who played for the Cal Bears after the war from 1945 through 1948 and was a lineman. Graduated from Cal in three seasons, enters UCSF medical school, but he still had a year of eligibility left. So he tried to play football while going to medical school. And halfway through the season, he went to the coach, Pappy Waldorf, and said, he just couldn't handle it both. And Waldorf said, fine. Well, they got hit by injuries. And so Waldorf called him back at the end of the season, and he played the last couple of games. Cal gets invited to the Rose Bowl, and he's got med school finals. So he brings a suitcase, as he described it, a suitcase full of medical textbooks to Pasadena and never opened the suitcase, but played in the Rose Bowl. I think his medical education must have gone well. He was one of the pioneers in organ transplants, which was a new field as he became a doctor. And by the time he finished, he had won the international prize awarded in organ transplantation. So an amazing story, an amazing man. And that came from a writer who I love named Ron Fimright, who wrote a history of Cal football, and John Najarian. That does it for our show. Ryan, I love doing this show. It's always fun to remember these people and to do it with you because you're as much of a history geek as I am.
Yeah. Well, as my wife has always said, the reason you and I get along is because when I start telling stories about Bobby Dodd, you're the only one that understands what I'm talking about. that's why we're friends. And listen, to that end, I know this show isn't about us and it isn't about you. But I'm going to make it about you for a minute because your time with ESPN is about to come to a close.
The last obit of the show.
Yeah, but you and I have I will never forget, probably like 4 or 5 years ago when you called and said, would you be interested in joining me for the In Memoriam podcast? And it was one of the great – I'm not exaggerating – one of the great thrills of my time at ESPN because I'm like, that's my favorite listen. And so it was an honor for you to ask me to do that. And it has been an honor to be your teammate for these years. And you have been so good to me, and our friendship is our friendship, but our time as teammates is coming to a close for now. And I just want to make sure I acknowledge that because everyone listening needs to know that. And people who listen to this have been listening to you on this podcast and certainly the previous version of this podcast for years. And so thank you for all of that.
Well, thank you. Very nice of you to say. And I've had a great run at ESPN. I'm going to continue running somewhere else. I'm not sure where yet. but my goal is that I'm going to do what I want to do and not do what I don't want to do. So, but that will almost assuredly include college football. I love writing about it and discussing it, and I fully intend to continue doing that in some form or fashion. Not sure where. Stay tuned, and stay tuned, of course, to the ESPN College Football Podcast. For Ryan McGee and for our producer Taylor Schwenk, thank you very much for downloading.